Right, that's the most attractive ones right now, especially for somebody my age who might be thinking about wanting to do this, is to get our repurposed drugs. Drugs that are, we already know the dangers of them. These things have been used for decades. They're FDA approved. Now it's being used to extend our lifespan.
I've heard from athletes that even though it extends your life, metformin can diminish your peak performance a bit. Is there any truth to
that? That I don't know.
You're not hanging out with my
lifters. I do not hang out with
no. What is it about protecting your insulin that allows your life to go longer?
It's related to the fact that you may have heard that if you are at the edge of starvation, so every animal that's been looked at, now humans, if you, this is called caloric restriction, if you're at the edge of starvation, and you do that for a substantial period of time, your rate of aging is decreased, you, and all these animals, live longer.
So that's like a proper scientist. How do you feel now that like things like intermittent...
Okay, so you've heard that, right? Which is caloric restriction. Being slender seems to extend life in all sorts of species, and quite a bit, which led to intermittent fasting. How many people do intermittent fasting here? Yeah, you're also, me too. You're also, good. You're also kind of a hip on this. So he's going to talk about intermittent fasting now. And he's going to talk about why it's probably true. And he's going to tell you something that is different than what you otherwise hear about why it works.
Fasting becomes so popular in like the bro science sphere.
I guess I'm a bro science guy. Again, there's so much information that still needs to come in. Intermittent fasting is looking very promising. It's certainly very promising for weight loss. But the reality is, and that's what my experience has been, it's probably just that you're skipping a meal.
Right, it's just a poor restriction. It doesn't have to do with your metabolism changing based off the time frame.
Well, there probably is a metabolic component, but how much of it is that is not clear.
Nice.
But I'm here.
I'm doing it.
Are you doing it?
Yeah, what's your time window?
Usually 1 in the afternoon to no later than 8 in the evening.
So you're doing the 16-8 thing?
Yeah, exactly. 16-8, 16-8, 17. Yeah. And you know what? I had the 83-inch waist not too long ago, so it worked pretty well. You know? I'm down 34 and I'm going smaller. I'm just kidding.
See, this guy is kind of irreverent, and so he's giving it back to him a little bit. You can hear well enough, right? Okay, good. This is not the world's best sound system.
Sure.
All right, so ethical quandaries. Now, this is really important stuff. Now, what is the ethics of if we extend lifespan?
Anshul?
That is one of the big challenges that I face in being the director of the Center for Aging and Longevity Studies. Every night I come home, my wife says, "Why are you doing this? There aren't too many people on the planet." So about 150 years ago, technological changes were made on the planet that dramatically increased life expectancy. Life expectancy 100 years ago was about half of what it is now. It's double that. The most important technology probably that contributed to that great increase in life expectancy was what? What would you guess? 150 years ago.
Was it sanitation?
Yes, sewers. That had more impact, my understanding, on life expectancy than any other technology.
Right.
Sewers. Piping away your poop.
Waste.
Right? Because now you could get water that wasn't tainted anymore. What that did was dramatically decrease infant mortality. Now, nutrition, agriculture, the Green Revolution, and of course modern medicine, dramatically changed infant mortality. And the biggest impact on life expectancy was the fact that infant mortality wasn't happening anymore. It's very rare, thank goodness, in the U.S. It's still there, but it's very rare. The problem with intervening with babies who are dying is that babies produce more babies. They turn into adults and they produce more babies. And in fact, that results in exponential growth. If you have 3 kids, like I did, those 3 kids, if they have 3 kids, you get exponential growth, right? Then you go from 1 billion people on the planet to 8 billion in 100 years. That's an enormous...
That's it.
So, because of that, we now are suffering the consequences of climate change. Had the population stayed at 1 billion, I don't think we'd have the problems we do. We would spew out 1/8 as much carbon dioxide. I think the planet could handle that. We would not be in the trouble. So, if you think about that from an ethical standpoint, you realize, if you could go back 150 years, would you have voted to not install sewers, right?
No, I'm for extended life and for the massive repurposed production of humans.
And you like Superbowl?
Yeah, I think it's in line with the idea that we're like a virus and it's our job to just keep going.
Okay, now let's say you had a drug. You have people before you that have dreadful disease, horrible disease of various types. You have a way to cure that. You have a way to cure it or ameliorate it, right? Is it ethical to hold that back?
No, I don't think
so. Okay, that's what we're in with life fantasy. We are going to, whether our center does it or not, we're going to discover interventions, drugs, maybe gene therapies, other treatments that will extend lifespan. By doing so, not lifespan per se, that's not our drive, by the way, it's to extend health span, the period of life in which we're vigorous, youthful, and disease-free. What we'd like to achieve is what's called compression of mortality, so we live healthy much longer. And then bang, gone.
Die quicker.
Yeah, instead of having this long, slow cut, right? And as these interventions are going to appear, is it ethical to hold back? So I would say it's not ethical. That's certainly the end. In fact, the number 6 or 7 tenet of the modern Hippocratic Oath says, whenever possible, use prevention. Because prevention is always superior to cure. This is about preventing age-related diseases. Right. Now, the problem is, because I think it's ethical to cure cancer, and I think it's ethical to intervene in cardiovascular disease, and if we get a cure, or at least an effective treatment in Alzheimer's, I think it's ethical to use that treatment. It's the same thing. If we extend health span, we are essentially diminishing these diseases, right? Especially if we get compression of mortality. We can almost, really reduce the number of diseases.
Chris, who's pushing back against you on these things?
A lot of people bring this up all the time. We had a debate. I hosted a debate at the university. I decided early on, we just had our grand opening launch in April. By June, I had a debate of a scientist and ethicist on both sides of the question. Should we extend healthy lifespan? Exactly the question you're asking. And we had the debate in front of a live audience, and then the audience voted before and after, which way, and actually my side lost. The room was filled with young people, students, and the students heard the last argument they heard is, do you really want Supreme Court justices who are in their 150s or 200s. This is counting the big enough problem.
Right, so you painted a dystopian picture well enough that you lost the vote.
Yeah,
I mean, people are dispirited about human nature in general, right. So they kind of want us to die.
Yeah, I guess that's it.
But so what is that the main argument that people have against extending
the income disparity is a big one, too. So Donald Trump could live to 500, but the people who keep my ability claim can't.
So do you have some kind of plan for like a universal basic life extension?
I'm not an economist. The market forces always drive down prices. Billionaires, whether you like them or not, will have access to it first, of course, just like everything else.
No, totally.
Everything else. But that disparity is going to fade. So we have people living to 200 years. Then society is going to adapt to that in the following way. Eventually, first it's going to be, it's very disruptive. It's a revolution. When we reach the stable level like that, people are going to start having babies in their 60s, right? They're going to be educated into their 30s and 40s, possibly, right? I can imagine that, right? They're going to have opportunities for many careers because their first career, if they did it right, they've accumulated enough wealth to sustain maybe re-education, or going out and doing what they want to do, and they have another opportunity to develop another career.
Right? So you're saying like things like parenting will be better because you'll have more experienced parents.
That was another one I was going to bring up.
Art will be better because they'll have more aggregate experience.
Yep.
So everything you see improving based off our longer lives.
No, I mean, certainly there are downsides. For example, because if it's a cult of personality and that personality stays around and they maintain popularity, which may not be good in society overall. Yep.
What do you think the process will be for life extension?
I can't put one answer to that, but I can tell you about some possibilities.
Yeah, go for it.
Okay, so the simplest one, drugs. We talked about rapamycin, metformin. There will be lots and lots of other drugs, other compounds that are going to do that.
So
I think that a cocktail is going to be necessary. The problem is aging is a very complex disease. You can't just hit one place.
It's probably unique to every person, too.
And that's another thing, is we'll need AI, we'll need machine learning to match the genome. With the
right person.
Exactly, that's exactly. So we'll need like the 7, let's say, and we'll need to match the genome. That's also an important thing. That's the easiest one because it's a drug development. Another one that's more challenging but is coming, I think it will be possible, is gene therapy. That would be we are infected with a virus. It's inactivated. The virus doesn't make us sick at all. All the virus does. A virus is just a delivery packet for DNA. That's all it is.
Yeah.
And so you can get a virus, it injects in your cells. a changed gene that extends your lifespan using the information we have for these little animals.
So that would be like a yearly shot or something like that?
It could be a one-shot deal.
Okay, so you get over there, baby, and it's in there.
This is a long way off.
And will it be time-sensitive? Like, will you have to get it while you're a baby, or will it be just as effective into adulthood?
I can't answer any of that because the answer is yes and no depending on what we develop.
It is almost like a tool where aging is accelerated.
Oh.
And so
you're making these guys like Jack. The Robin Williams movie where he aged at 4 times the rate of average human.
Yeah.
So can you guys jack a human? But you could.
No, you wouldn't.
Theoretically. Well, because ethically you would, but you have the capacity if you were amoral to do it.
Yeah.
Dude.
That's why any kind of gene manipulation in humans has to be heavily regulated.
Right. Could you, at a time, ever make it portable where it's like in a shop, and then I can just stab someone and jack them? Okay, it's more complicated.
It's a lot more complicated than that. What has to happen is you need those edits to happen in every cell of the body, so it has to be done in the embryo. Very early, so then whatever edits you make are then inherited by all the cells.
Right. So if you jack someone, you have to jack into your jizz.
Yeah. Oh, that's not the end
goal. So I can't do a period.
My wife's mother died of ALS, Lou Gehrig's, and I was studying this process called programmed cell suicide, which underlies this ALS and lots of other neurodegenerative diseases, and it every time I wasn't focusing on my work and trying to push the edge in our work that was relevant to this, it bugged me because I thought maybe I could cure it, right? So yeah, this hangs over my head.
You feel personal responsibility.
Yeah. Now, fortunately, most of my closest relatives, my wife is, you know, my closest relative. She's my age. We got to go through it together. But my parents are gone, and so my children, you know, I don't have to worry about, at least I don't have to worry about losing them, I hope to goodness, but certainly not because of aging.
Do you think death gives meaning to life?
Yeah, so what would happen if I lived, if I were immortal, would I feel like my life would be meaningful? I personally would not feel that way, but I've heard a lot of people say that, yes, in a way it would take away meaning, and it would take away the sense, certainly the sense of urgency of doing something. It would perhaps, and people have argued this, take away the drive to accomplish something. Because you just have forever to accomplish it. So I think, from that standpoint, I think death would be very, knowing that we're mortal creatures has a real impact on the way we think about things. And there's psychologists we work with in the center of it who actually deal with exactly that issue. Personally, I can't tell because I'm not, you know, I know I'm mortal, but I personally just love living so much. I'm not sure it would go.
I totally agree. And I think it'd be nice to be able to have a century that you dedicate towards work and a century that you dedicate towards leisure.
You go back and forth.
Yeah, you have the opportunity to change life and leisure. And then also, if we were immortal, suicide would go way up.
If we were immortal, possibly.
Because people would have to decide their own time to leave.
Sure, as long as you can leave. Then, you know, what's wrong with immortality? I mean, except the world population.
Yeah, but would immortality change our relationship to suicide?
Are you fertile?
Yeah, I have 2 kids.
Okay, so where did the cells come from?
Where did it come from?
Yeah. Came from your cells.
Yeah.
And your cells were whatever age you were when you sired those kids, right?
Mm-hmm.
Where did the cells come from before that? You kept going back. The cells divided two, and then they divided in. Where did they go back? Where did they go?
My dad?
Yeah. And where did that go back?
His dad.
That was immortal. That's a line of cells that went on immortally. That is a human line of cells that is immortal. We have immortality in us in that regard. All that means is that it's certainly biologically tenable that if we can figure out how that rebooting occurs when an egg is fertilized, how those cells are rebooted to be young again, why can't that be applied to any of ourselves? And I think it's...
That's like the monologue from Barry Child, Sam Shepard, like, where he's trying to drive away from his family of origin, and he looks in the rearview mirror, and his face becomes the face of everyone who came before him, his dad and his grandfather, and he says, every breath marks him, it marks him forever.
Awesome. I was thinking exactly that.
But what do you mean by that, though? You're unlocking the immortality. Does that mean that, like, I'm now my dad and my kids?
No, it means that something happened when that egg was fertilized and created your kids to refresh, to reboot the cell. It's no longer an old cell, it's a brand new cell, right?
So you're going to have sex on every person to cleanse them?
I don't think that would be the right thread. But you can use what happens in sex more properly during fertilization and the creation of a fresh egg.
So what happens in that process?
If you want, you can look at worm sex downstairs. They set that up for you.
Why worms?
So these guys were originally picked up as an experimental system a long time ago because you can do so much with them. You can do so much. You can understand their genetics very quickly, and you ask questions very deeply. You can get huge numbers. You can take one of these hermaphrodites and wait 10 days on a petri plate like you'll see in the lab. How many do you think you'll have in 10 days? One of these?
1,000.
You will have 30 million.
What?
Yeah, so they grow extremely fast. So you can get a lot.
Hey, reproduce that quickly? Does worm sex feel good for both sides? And do they intermingle with each other? Like, is it incest?
The males and the hermaphrodites mate with each other. I guess you'd call it incest because they're all genetically, they're siblings for sure. Oh, totally. Completely incest.
So is there any kind of Habsburg thing where they start having the same defect?
No.
Like they slobber?
No, they don't slobber.
So what are you doing with Project Star?
What really drives me is understanding the limits of survival.
Okay, so I got to tell you that we're going to come back to the worms. We're going to look much more closely at C. elegans. That's the next thing we're going to do. But now he's going to his other project, which is pretty fascinating, this Starlight project. They say, let's go back here so you can see that.
What are you doing with Project Starlight?
What really drives me is understanding the limits of survival with two parameters, time and space. So I've just focused on time. Aging, longevity, developmental biology, it's all about the interface between time on living systems. That's what aging is. Space is the other one. What are the limits of survival in space? I heard that my colleague Philip Lubin, who I think you've spoken to, had developed a way of sending small spacecraft to the next star system, Alpha Centauri star system. So these are little tiny craft, they call them star chips, because they're just a little tiny, they're like the size of a compact disc or something like that. And I approached them and said, have you thought about putting life on site on these things? Because we'd like to figure out what happens to life as it passes through interstellar space. And he was very confused by this, but I explained that we work on these little animals that we can get on board these things. We have a possibility in your lifetime, maybe not mine, but probably in your lifetime, where we can actually do this experiment. To get to the next star, if you're relying on NASA or Elon Musk, will take how long?
10 years.
50 to 100,000.
50 to 100,000?
Yes, that's the fastest we can do. Build the fastest rocket you build is going to be 50,000 to 100,000 years, right? Mm-hmm. So we ain't going to see this.
No.
Right? Build is designed with a laser propulsion system. So that means you can get to the next star in 20 years. In your lifetime, you might see this happen.
And can we even see it when it's going? Like physically?
Yeah, I mean, we could probably see it. It's very small, too. But it will be sending signals back. It uses laser, the same laser array that you use to send up the thing can receive the signal coming back from you.
How do you decide which species gets sent on the station?
Okay, so we decide this because what we need, okay, how are you going to get an animal on board this thing, right? It has to be very small. It has to have very cheap and simple life support. It has to be able to withstand massive gravitational forces. When these things are accelerated, they get something like 100,000 times G. That is, it's as if we weigh 100,000 times as much. We die at 10 G, right? So 100,000 times. They have to withstand that. And they have to be able to be put in suspended animation. The little worms that I talked about, they can be put in suspended. They're tiny. They fulfill all those criteria. We can freeze them. I'll show you.
But do they have the life expectancy that's necessary for the trip?
They're frozen. So their life expectancy is virtually infinite as long as they're frozen.
What is cryptobiosis?
So that's the other one. So with worms, we can sit and freeze them and take them anytime we want to study lots of stuff along with. Cryptobiosis is the process that these other microscopic creatures go through. These tardigrades, these little guys, right? These things. These guys can undergo lots of different types of cryptobiosis.
That's the other guy?
That's the other guy. These are two defects, by the way. These guys have eight legs. These are microscopic. They're called water bears. They look kind of like bears. And these guys can dry out completely. That's a form of cryptobiosis. It's actually called anhydrobiosis, removal of all the water. In that dry form, you can get a bunch of these little guys, and if you go down to the lab, you'll see them crawling around. You can dry it now and make a powder. So it's like a dry powder in the animal. And you can take that powder and stick it into the vacuum of space for weeks, and then bring it back in and give them water and they walk off. This animal can survive the vacuum of space in that dry form. Now, so what we can do is we can put those on the chip without any water, and then we have a little liver system and a droplet.
Wait, so they can be outside in space?
They can be outside in space, just exposed to the vacuum of space. An animal. Watching a movie, they kind of look like a dog. They go around here, move their heads around.
Do they have a sense of smell?
Yeah, absolutely. Oh, for sure.
Wow.
That's how they find their food.
What a sick animal.
Or things that they don't like. It's pretty sick animal. These are really sick animals.
What is your hope?
My hope as a scientist is just that I will be able to take my laptop computer and watch these guys do their behavior or develop whatever it is I want to look at while they're at the next star. And there it is, live. Now, it's not live because it takes 4 years for the light to come back here. So it's always going to be 4 years later. But still, I'm watching the light happen that we, you know, may get there near the next star system. That's pretty cool. And then we can ask how healthy they are. My guess is they're going to be fine, but we don't know.
So if they can live there, it could potentially mean that we can live there?
That's the reason to do it. Who were the very first astronauts?
Neil Armstrong. Oh, no, the Russians.
Okay.
Monkeys.
Yes, even before that, it was fruit flies and mice, right? Those were the first things set up. We didn't want to send humans up in orbit until we knew it was okay. These are the...
Spam
the
can.
Yeah, exactly. These are the guys. These are the monkeys. These are the dogs, etc. to send up first. If we're ever going to go into interstellar distance, we better know it's okay for life. We can even test whether it affects memories.
What do you think about NASA's mission to send an orbiter to Europa on Jupiter?
The most exciting thing that I can think of that could happen in my life is discovery of life somewhere else that evolved independently of us.
And if they do find life in Europa's ocean, how does that affect your work?
There's another experiment in evolution. This is rich with the questions that we have.
Well, it's because all the ingredients and the components would be different, so it'd be all brand new.
We don't know that, but that's possible.
But that's what excites you about it.
Sure. How do you get life with other components, for example? Or how do you get life? You know, it's a second example of it. If it's really independent, it tells us, it teaches us.
Anything in personal matter.
We have to be very careful, by the way, not to contaminate the other planets. That's a big problem. NASA really worries about this. Planetary detection.
So you think we need to worry about contaminating other planets?
Yes. Absolutely. We already did it with the moon. We really wrapped it up when we contaminated Mars, too.
So just with all the space travel we have?
Yeah. And you'd say, oh, well, the craft were sterilized. You can't sterilize. The rocket goes through the atmosphere, which is, has living stuff in it, right? And then when you release whatever the
So it's like colonizing very smallpox and native populations.
Yeah, effectively. I think we probably brought microorganisms to Mars, even though we didn't want to.
What could be the negative consequences of that?
You could wipe out the native species, I think.
What is the panspermia hypothesis?
The panspermia hypothesis is that life, and I don't really like the idea because it just chases the whole question back, but life sprung up elsewhere, it traversed the cosmos and landed in some form, bacterial cells or something, on the Earth. 3.7 billion years ago or so, whenever life started, roughly that period. And then evolution occurred from those seeds that were created. All that does is chase back the question, where did life really start? But that's the notion of panspermia. This experiment kind of tests whether at least panspermia is in any way conceivable.
Right, because if these organisms can exist on other star systems, it means it could have started there and then come to us.
Yeah, and I think it would be able to, but that's, you know.
But you don't think that validates the hypothesis?
It supports the hypothesis. It does prove it. I don't know if the only way we'll ever be able to prove it, we will be able to prove panspermia exists. We might not know which direction. But if we find life elsewhere, and it is based on the same molecules that our life is, and has, most importantly, the same genetic code. So we're all coded with a specific code. You can easily change the code differently depending on evolution. If they have the same genetic code, that the life on that planet and this planet came from the same place.
Henry Kissinger lived to be 100. What do you think he was doing right?
I don't think he probably did anything right. I think he was a little right. He looked a little heavy to me.
What do you consider right?
I don't like to use the word. Advanced age.
Who do you think is the hottest advanced age person?
Okay, so I'm never sexual, so I'm going to say a female, right? I wish Audrey Hepburn were still alive, but she's not.
Are you anyone else?
I would not say I'm anyone, no.
But you're married by one.
Well, that is true. She's a mother.
Exactly.
And an enjoyer.
Yeah.
A person. And in lots of ways, too.
If Alexander the Great was still alive, do you think he'd do TikToks about being bisexual?
Yeah, probably now.
That's cool, because I don't think it would hurt his ability to be a conqueror.
No, of course not.
But I'm progressive.
Yeah, well, me too. But you think pretty good about it.
But I've also kissed guys.
Well, I have too. I kissed my sons, my father.
You made me excited for the future, and I'm really grateful that intelligent, compassionate people like you are working on this stuff. Is it hard for you to be sincere?
Yes.
That's about it. He's good for a little.
Hey, you ever seen a wealthy person or a wealthy family or a jet owner? I got a jet, I'm sorry. No. You ever done that scene?
Thank you. All right, so that, let's see. So that's a little bit about Dr. Joel Rothman, a great guy, obviously. If you want to see that again, it's very easy to see. You just go to YouTube, and you search Dr. Joel Rothman, and it'll be the second thing that'll come up. And now what I want to do in this last half an hour, 45 minutes, is this
the interviewer?
What's it?
Who's the interviewer?
I don't know who the interviewer was, but he does something called the after-school program. In this next 25 minutes, I want to tell you a little bit more about C. elegans, which is the worm that he uses, because it's the most important single animal in biology, I think. And then, in the last couple of minutes, I want to show you a video about tardigrades, the things that can exist in space. It's amazing. They're two amazing creatures. So here we go. Anybody want to say anything real quick? All right, so let's go to...
it's like elegant.
Yes. So we're going to go to...
Some people just have seeds on one hand.
Yes.
And it's it.
Okay.
What do we want?
Okay, so this is the Whitehead Institute at MIT, and this is you go to Whitehead Institute, C. elegans, and you come up with this the videos, but this I just want to show you this. There we go. This is the article on C. elegans, how C. elegans wormed its way into science stardom. It's pretty amazing what has been done with this animal and why this animal is the animal of choice. So I've selected just a few things to read to you from this article. First, the introduction. Okay, I don't want that. I just want this. There we go. Michael Stubna, a graduate student who, a graduate student in Whitehead Institute member David Bartel's laboratory, peers into his microscope with a petri dish full of agar gel below. He spots one of his research specimens, a millimeter-long nematode worm known as C. elegans. C. elegans, slithering across the coating of bacteria, the worm's food source, on a gel on the surface of the gel. The worm leaves sinuous tracks in its wake, like a skier slaloming down a slope. So, let me show you a 2-minute video of that. I'm not sure about the sound, but we'll see.
There we go. I am Michael Stubna. I am a graduate student in Bartella.
Stubna works with C. elegans, tiny translucent worms that live in soil.
They can help researchers, including student data, answer questions about how gene expression is regulated.
Right now, I only have a couple individual animals on here, but it's possible to grow many 10 of 15 centimeter plates at a time to get tens or even hundreds of thousands of worms at a time.
While Stupa stores its worms at 68 degrees Fahrenheit, living worms can be frozen indefinitely in liquid nitrogen at negative 320 degrees.
Yeah, so manipulating sea algae is very easy. You can pick individual worms up with this little worm pick and move them to different petri plates. And that is done by making this worm pick, which is basically a piece of wire stuck inside of a glass tube, and you sterilize that with flame. It's a skill that has to be learned, but it's learned very quickly, and it's one of the most basic skills in handling sea algae.
The worms live their lives on petri plates, which are coated with bacteria culture. This bacterial lawn is the worm's source of food. As a sea elegans travels across the plate, it carves out a path in the bacterial culture, like a skier making tracks in fresh snow. Why raise sea elegans? These worms are helping researchers like Steve answer questions about how levels of proteins are regulated in cells.
One mechanism that the cell has to track.
That gets a little complicated, so I'm going to skip that second part. You can see it for yourself, because I want to get to the real answer about why C. elegans is so important, and I can do that this way. So, making models, production model. Just want to show you C. elegans from back there. Okay, making a model. Two paragraphs. The species C. elegans was first identified and used in research after being found in the soil in Algeria around 1900. However, its popularity as a research model skyrocketed in the 1970s after biologist Sidney Brenner, then at the Medical Research Council Laboratory of Molecular Biology, and later the founder of the Molecular Sciences Institute, made the case for it as the best new model species for the field of molecular biology. What makes C. elegans such a good model organism? The worm exists in a just right zone of biological complexity. It is complex enough to have many of the features that researchers want to study, but simple enough so those same features can be examined comprehensively. For example, each C. elegans has 302 neurons, nerve cells. We have 1 trillion. So it has 302 neurons, which is enough to be a useful model for everything from questions about how brains form, to how they sense and respond to stimuli, to how neuronal pathways give rise to specific behaviors, to how different diseases cause neurodegeneration. At the same time, 302 neurons is small enough for researchers to be able to study each individual neuron and its connections thoroughly. In comparison, a fruit fly has around 100,000 neurons. So they have mapped not only the neurons of the C. elegans, all 302 neurons, they know where they are. They've also mapped all the connections of all the neurons, called the connectome. So they can see what's happening, what neuron is connecting with what neuron in real time. They can look at, this is connecting with this, it's connecting with this. The human connectome, there's a project to map the human connectome, but it's impossible because it keeps changing every moment. But the human connectome, rather than having, I'm guessing for C. elegans, 302, probably less than 100,000 connections in the whole connectome, because 302 and probably a couple of hundred. No, probably it only connects to 10, a couple of thousand connections for their connectome. Our connectome is 86 billion neurons in the brain connected on average to 5,000 other neurons, which comes out to be 500 trillion connections, approximately. So it's a little hard to connect to figure out what's going on our brain. It's pretty easy to see what's going on exactly in that nematode's nervous system. But that's not the only thing that makes C. elegans is important. Let me show you a couple more things. The
Yeah, go. Whoops. Celium inside out.
After Brenner landed on C. elegans as an ideal model, his research group began several ambitious projects to comprehensively understand the worm's biology. In the following decades, the worm's anatomy and genome would be detailed in unprecedented detail. We know all about this worm. The more that researchers learned about the worm, the better model it became. C. elegans is remarkable in that every worm has exactly the same number of cells, 959 in the adult hermaphrodite, not counting the cells that would become egg or sperm. We have 37 trillion, of which, by the way, 70 to 84% are red blood cells. So we only have about 10 trillion cells that aren't red blood cells. But then this worm has 959 cells. 300 of these are neurons. Researchers in Brenner's group created the first of their kind resources documenting the details of this biology. First, they mapped the worm's complete cell lineage, recording every cell division that occurred during the worm's development from fertilized egg to adult. They know exactly how this thing developed from a fertilized egg to an adult. Every single cell division was mapped. This resource makes it easy for researchers to study how different factors contribute to or can alter this development. So they're an unbelievably good model for biological development.
And there's one more paragraph here I want to read to you.
Then the researchers create a wiring diagram or connectome of the hermaphrodite worm's 302 neurons and their thousands of synapses, the junction points where nerves interact. Researchers have used this wiring diagram to identify neurons involved in many different behaviors in C. elegans, as well as to understand how brains form and function across animal species. C. elegans was the first, and as of 2021, the only animal to have its brain completely mapped.
There's one more thing about C. elegans that you ought to know.
In 1998, C. elegans made the news as the first animal to have its complete genome sequenced. Everything it had, all about its genes. The completion of a 15-year-long sequencing project helmed by the C. elegans sequencing consortium was announced in a special issue of Science. Researchers had previously compiled complete genomes for a variety of single-celled species, but as an animal, C. elegans had a significantly larger genome. The complete genome provided many useful insights into individual genes and the relationships between genes both within C. elegans and between species. This ambitious project also proved instructive for how to sequence large genomes. In fact, the Human Genome Project helped to fund the sequencing of C. elegans as a stepping stone. The ultimate goal of sequencing the human genome, which was achieved in 2003. So, C. elegans, we know every cell, we know every cell division in its life, we know every connection in the brain, and we know everything about its genome. So, it was maybe the first species where they could put light-sensitive proteins in the cells and then light up individual cells and watch the cells in action. So this animal has been studied thoroughly to try to understand us. And there's a big deal. Some of you know that there's a whole worm culture that's talked about. There's Worm Runner's Digest. There's people all over the world who are researchers that do research on C. elegans. I won't have... Maybe I'll have time for one more thing here about that. No. Model for aging. That's the last thing I want to show you here. So where is it? Discovery of the developments. Model for aging. Yeah. In 1993, Cynthia Kenyon at the University of California, San Francisco, and colleagues, discovered that the mutations to a single gene, DAF2, along with normal activity of a second gene, DAF16, could more than double the lifespan of C. elegans. One mutation doubled the lifespan of this animal. Kenyon and others, intrigued by this discovery, would go on to use C. elegans to ask researchers about the molecular mechanisms governing aging. Researchers have also studied how equivalent genes affect aging in other animals, including humans. I don't have time to show you this, but my fraternity brother, Bob Horvitz, won a Nobel Prize in 2002 for becoming the first researcher on programmed cell death, how our cells know to die. It's called apoptosis, spelled apoptosis, but apoptosis is how you pronounce it. And he used C. elegans to figure out how cells know it's time to stop. Because if we can figure out how they stop, we can stop them from stopping, number one. And number two, the difference between cells which undergo apoptosis and cancer cells is cancer cells have a protection so they don't stop replicating. And they may form tumors. So if we can turn off the mechanism that protects cancer cells from undergoing apoptosis, they will die. And many of the newer cancer therapies are doing exactly that. They're targeting cancer cells' protection against the cell dying and deactivating that so that the cell dies and the tumor dies. That's a little bit about C. elegans. Now I just want to introduce you to tardigrades in the last couple of minutes, okay? Just because tardigrades are so weird. And so wonderful. So I need to, just a 7 or 8 minute video. Okay, so I am going to YouTube again. Now let me blank this out for a second, go to YouTube.
To you by Skillshare. Tardigrades are the most resilient animals in the universe, and there's probably one within a stone's throw from you right now. Hi, I'm Danielle, and you're watching Animal Logic. Tardigrades are a phylum of microanimals that are found pretty much everywhere on the planet, from the depths of the ocean, to jungles, to rivers, to mud volcanoes. There are over 1,000 species of tardigrade distributed across 3 classes, Eutardigrada, Heterotardigrada, and Mesotardigrada. The main difference between the first two, Eutardigrada and Heterotardigrada, is that Eutardigrada have a single orifice for reproduction and digestion, while Heterotardigrada have separate ones. The third class, Mesotardigrada, has only been described by a single specimen discovered in 1937. The specimen was lost in an earthquake and no others have been found. Possible that this class doesn't exist. Tardigrades were first discovered in 1773 and at the time were named water bears. This is due to the fact that they are normally found in fresh water and their movements resemble the gait of a bear. The name tardigrade means slow stepper, which is in reference to their relatively slow movement speed. Tardigrades are literally microscopic. Depending on the species, they range in size from 0.1 to 1.5 millimeters in length. Their body has a head, 3 segments with a pair of legs on each, and a caudal segment, a tail, with another pair of legs. Their legs have no articulation and have four claws at the end made of chitin, the same material that makes up a crab's shell. They use their front six legs to grab things to propel themselves forward. Their rear pair of legs is used to grab onto the floor while they use their other six legs to nab food. Adult tardigrades have a set amount of cells, and every member of the same species will have exactly the same number of cells. This is called eutaly, and it mainly occurs in microscopic organisms. Baby tardigrades are born with a full number of cells, and rather than undergo cell division, they grow as their cells do. Tardigrades don't have any respiratory organs, and instead are able to do a gas exchange throughout their whole body. Their mouth has stylets, which are like sharp little teeth. They use these to pierce plants and small invertebrates, after which they feed on the leaked fluids. Most species of tardigrade have compound eye cups, and their bodies are lined with little hairs that help them feel vibrations. Tardigrades do have anal ducts, and some of them only do their business when they molt. Another act that they save for molting is laying eggs. After the female molts and lays eggs, the male will fertilize them. This mating process can last for over an hour. But tardigrades aren't famous for their sex lives. They're famous for their ability to tolerate environments that would kill other animals in seconds. This is primarily true for terrestrial tardigrades. Marine tardigrades aren't quite as resilient, as their habitats are much more stable. In the most extreme of conditions, terrestrial tardigrades can mummify themselves into little shriveled glass tardies called tongues, and in the state, they can withstand a whole heck of a lot. Some species can survive at almost absolute zero, -273°C. On the hot side of things, they can survive for extended periods of time in temperatures of over 150°C, far past the boiling point of water. They aren't able to live in these extreme temperatures forever. The longer they stay, the lower their chances of survival. They can live several days at -200°C and up to 30 years at -20°C. During these extremely cold situations, they enter a state called cryobiosis. In order to protect themselves from the expanding water inside their cells, they release cryoprotectants, which make the ice crystallize in a way that is less damaging to their cells. Tardigrades can take a lot more than temperature, though. Some species are able to withstand pressures that are 6 times higher than those encountered at the bottom of the Mariana Trench,
which is about the same amount of pressure that we get to talk about bearded dragons on Animal Logic.
Some species of tardigrade can survive inside a vacuum and have even survived in outer space, where they're exposed to both a vacuum and solar radiation, as they were in an experiment by the European Space Agency in 2007.
Even their DNA is resilient.
It can tolerate extreme amounts of radiation due to a protein called a damage suppressor that protects it. The protein reduces X-ray damage by 40%. Tardigrades can tolerate 1,000 times more radiation than most other animals.
If you received a dose of about 5 gray of radiation, you would die. A tardigrade, however, can withstand 5,000 gray.
Tardigrades can also survive air deprivation and will simply float around until they're in a spot where they can breathe again. Same goes for dehydration.
They can survive with just 3% of their water content, shriveling up to just 1/3 of their size.
Similarly, some species of tardigrade can go without eating for 30 years, after which they dry out, become dormant, and then they can rehydrate, eat something, and carry on as if nothing had happened. It is rare for a tardigrade to go 30 years without food, but they fairly regularly will go for at least 5 years without eating.
People tend to call tardigrades extremophiles, but they're not.
An extremophile is an animal, usually a bacteria, that has adapted to live in an extreme environment. Tardigrades are just really good at living wherever they want, be it the Himalayas, in the depths of the ocean, or in your backyard.
Tardigrades have survived 5 mass extinctions, and unlike every other animal that we cover on this channel, they're well equipped to survive the next one. If you're interested in getting started in scientific illustration, a good starting point is with a course on Skillshare.
Head in ink, scientific illustration, taught by artists and educators.
Well, that's just an advertisement at the end. As I kind of left, sitting through the morning, I just wanted you to be astounded at how evolution works. That this little, dumb little species has figured out how to do all this amazing stuff that we can't do. So somehow it learned, by random mutation, supposedly, it developed all these incredible abilities in order to stay alive in every environment. And I gotta say one last thing about, okay, so you've heard about intelligent design, the idea that somebody is designing all this, and, you know,
I have an article about this on EdHack right now.
Okay, so look, if you, those of you who are EdHack people, Robert has an article on this. But the idea is, the idea of intelligent design is there's somebody designing this because it's so beautifully designed. And science generally poo-poos that, says, no, this is random mutations that result in all these amazing adaptations. That's where I come from, but when you take a step back and you see what life has done in order to stay alive in all its different forms, you think that even if nobody designed this, what occurred was unbelievable brilliance. So there's something about the universe that is extremely brilliant, even if it's not something that made the universe be brilliant. The emergent property of life is brilliance. It's a different idea, but it's the same conclusion, which is that they figured out great stuff. All right, so this is just a little bit of, this morning was a little bit about longevity and a little bit about the leading edge of biological science. So I hope that it was fun anyway. And I will see you next week.
It's pardon?